Okay.
All right.
Hi.
And then you're.
One more time.
You're listening to
Keyboard and Quill
from Startree, creators of the Real Time Analytics Summit
and podcast.
I'm Tim Berglund.
I'm Rachel Podreski. In today's episode of Keyboard and Quill, we're going to continue looking at how we got from mainframes to the cloud of today, jumping in with the world's first microcomputers.
For many people's experience using the internet, which is just a part of life now, it required, at least initially, a computer at home, right?
Yeah, that makes total sense. That would be how you would experience the world of computers if you were not in a corporation that could afford one.
Yeah, you don't want to go to your office with some uncomfortable business attire on and use the mini computer there that's connected to the internet. You'd want something smaller, cheaper. You'd want what came to be called a microcomputer.
Is a microcomputer 1/1000th of a mini computer?
The prefixes would lead you to believe that, but oddly, no.
Oh, well, yes. That's disappointing.
It is, isn't it? It seems like it should be. But January 1975, the magazine Popular Electronics features on its front cover a little piece of equipment called the Altair 8800.
So it was like a cover model.
Cover model.
For the microcomputer.
For the microcomputer. And really launched the era as kind of a home and hobbyist thing, which that's computing hasn't been that yet.
So is this the beginning of the storied homebrew groups and Radio Shack?
We are now in Tim's lifetime, and I will tell stories. But yeah, the Homebrew Computer Club, which I should know this, Cupertino, Sunnyvale, somewhere very near where we are in the studio right now, was meeting, and these two guys named Steve, that would be Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, the founders of Apple Computer, showed their Apple Computer. 2 years later, 1977, the Apple II is launched. You said Radio Shack. They had a machine called the TRS-80. And those of us of a certain age actually have memories of these machines. And some of our hosts here on this show have personal memories of these machines. I remember probably would have been like 79, 80, maybe. I was a big fan of Radio Shack back then, young 8-year-old Tim. They sold electronic components in the back. You go back and look at those. This is just my life. And in the front, they had these computers. And you could go type things and write the little basic program that prints your name over and over again. They had one that had a program running on it called Eliza.
Oh, tell me about Eliza.
You remember Eliza? Okay. Eliza was, I think it's described as an early AI thing. And AI, and frankly, until very recently, it was kind of not useful.
I think it was just a bunch of if-then-else statements.
It really was, yeah. Because the machine didn't have much to do, but it would look for ways to parse things you typed and regurgitate them to you. Eliza also absolutely captivated a young Tim. I just couldn't believe that this sort of thing was real.
It explains so much about you.
It really does. Knew it needed to be a part of my life. So yeah, microcomputers are off and running. These are small. I think that the original Altair 8800, maybe in today's dollars, would have been like a $5,000 purchase, something like that. So, you know, spendy, but if you're serious about it and you've got a little bit of disposable income, you'll get into that. Rachel, what's your first memory of an interaction with the computer? Where does this come online for you?
I remember my dad coming home with what he called an IBM clone, and it had a very large floppy disk. And I could put something called DOS into the
floppy disk with DOS on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was floppy. It was not a hard floppy disk. It was a floppy disk.
5 1/4 inch, actually flexible plastic thing.
Yes. I'm making flexible plastic hand gestures at the moment.
Let the record show.
Right. Let the record show. And it had an orange screen because he said the oranges were better for your eyes than the green, even though I guess my mom was using a computer at work and she was like, but all my computers are green. He's like, nope, orange. Orange is a better monitor screen. We also had a BASIC 2 floppy disk. So I could learn to write BASIC code. And I remember creating my little menu of commands and send go to line one or go to line two. And and the big adventure that we had one day with it is my dad had to send it back. And I'm like, Dad, why are you sending back our computer? He says, I need to upgrade the memory or the RAM in order to put in a hard drive. And all of those words sounded very like strange and mystical to young Rachel.
Yes.
And all it meant is that when I got it back, I didn't actually have to put those floppy disks in anymore.
Game changer.
Total game changer.
Game changer. Yeah.
Yep. Ah. And we did have computers at school. We mostly used them to play games like Lemonade and Oregon Trail.
Yeah. Lemonade was a lemonade stand simulator.
Lemonade stand simulator. Exactly. And we did typing.
Mavis Beacon. Did she teach you typing?
No. It was some type of like Space Invaders program.
Okay.
And we had to type the letter. But yeah, I thought that was, now looking back, I realized that we weren't doing any programming. And I remember my dad getting kind of upset that we weren't using our computers to do any programming.
Oh, that's why he wanted you to be using BASIC to write BASIC programs.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. He wanted me to learn to program. And I think maybe that's why, because the school was using the computers to teach us typing, that he was trying to get me to learn to code.
Okay. Well, that was actually good guidance.
Yeah, it was great. And I remember one Christmas Eve, we were standing outside looking at the stars. This is Southern California, so it was warm enough to stand outside and look at the stars. And he said, you know, Rachel, computers are the future. You need to, like, get into computers.
Wow.
I know.
Okay. Since we're doing personal stories, I talked about that encounter with the TRS-80 and Eliza. Great Uncle Ralph had a TRS-80 with a little Lunar Lander video game on it. He was famously grumpy with the young ones. He called us grubbies. But let me use his computer. That was a transformative moment. And then fifth grade, I bought a book on basic programming. No computer, right? I just read the book.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't read the book.
And it was 1982. Got a VIC-20, Commodore VIC-20 for Christmas that year.
And oh, that was so nice of Santa.
Back Santa. Yeah. My dad didn't get an IBM clone. He got a non-IBM compatible DOS machine.
Wow.
In the early 80s, those were a thing.
He was the beta of the VHS days.
He absolutely was.
The Zune of the iPod
and
days.
Years later, I went on to be an Amiga 500 owner, repeating the mistake. But let me tell you, it's technically superior. Let me explain. Where are you going? You know, definitely affected the way I think about technology adoption even now. But
I had a Zune, personally.
You had a Zune?
I had a Zune.
Oh, that is courageous for you to admit that on air. I appreciate that. I started with an iPod Shuffle, I think, and never looked back. But 2 points. One, you know, now folks around our age, this era of computing history is absolutely touching our lives and things we remember. Okay, so we're primary sources.
Yep.
Two, there is this flowering in microcomputers, right? Everybody is making one, different approaches. You get the Apple ecosystem, and that Altair ecosystem kind of thrived for a few years, started to go away by the late 70s. And now the IBM PC, Compaq comes in, starts making computers compatible with the IBM. This is 1982.
They had cow motifs, right? No.
Oh, that was Gateway.
Gateway.
That was Gateway. Gateway 2000, a computer company from Iowa, not recognized as a tech hotbed, but they were a brand. They moved some... I didn't buy one until 95. My first Pentium machine was a Gateway 2000.
Pentium Pro processor.
It was just Pentium, not the Pro, but these are details our listeners need. Dell, you know, a lot of you may have owned a Dell. You may use a Dell laptop at work if you don't use an Apple. They were called Dell in 1988, founded in 1985. So there's just this flowering of all these different computer companies making different computers. And Apple has a history here too. Amiga had a history. Other ways of being a PC that at this point didn't end up being the winners.
And let's define a PC here means a personal computer.
Yeah.
As opposed to one that you would use at work.
That you would share. And I think what's really happening here is now that computation, input-output devices, displays, storage, all these things are cheap enough and good enough that you can put them on a desk. You can have one at home. At this point in the 80s, you kind of have to be pretty bought in.
Right.
But at work, more and more people are getting them on desks, and they're useful enough and cheap enough that all that stuff can live right there.
Yeah, well, in 94, when I headed off to university, because I had experience with my PC at home, I became the person in my dorm that fixed everybody's computers for them.
Nice.
Until somebody showed up with an Apple. And I realized that I know nothing about this machine. What type of wonder is this that it doesn't have a motherboard that I can stick stuff into?
I know, right? I need sockets. I need things that plug and little
jumpers. I don't even know how to open it.
Right, right. Isn't it glued shut? That was always my joke. I was very, very disrespectful to the Mac back then.
Me too, as we both sit here with Macs in front of us.
Dedicated Mac user since 2008. So yeah, it's good enough, cheap enough. You have one on your desk. And there's another missing piece here. We have to back up in the time machine a little bit. with all these computers at work, maybe now you're a office person, professional knowledge worker, whatever it is you are, you've got a PC on your desk. Some people did. Those need to talk to each other.
Oh, interesting. And they weren't doing it through those like big orange envelopes with the strings.
No, not fun, right? You could have a little printer next to you and print stuff out and stick it in the orange envelope and the mail room would go do it, right?
Right.
Yeah, not how it worked. And it's kind of funny when you think now, most of what you do with your computer is you access the internet.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what this history is about, is this move towards the cloud. That's kind of this story we're telling. But back before, these computers weren't internet. There was an internet, but they weren't connected to it usually. And you're like, what did you do?
What is it even called? If it wasn't the internet, what was this thing that they connected to?
Before there was even a connection, right? You might just put a file on a floppy disk and give it to somebody else, but you're doing things on the computer.
Or you put it into your orange envelope.
Or yeah, there you send it to the mailroom again, yeah. But it's the same dang stuff we do now. A lot of my job is in Google Docs and Google Sheets.
Yep, me too.
Because we happen to use Google here.
As we are looking at a Google Doc right now
look at our outline. In a studio, it's in a Google Doc. Okay, so back then, in an office, you did stuff and you did calculations and models and predictions and stuff. You used a spreadsheet and a word processor. They were different programs. Those files were stored on your actual computer, on its hard disk or whatever. Right?
So how did you share them with people?
This is where networking kind of re-enters the chat. Now, we had mainframes, we had mini computers, we had ways of connecting them. And, you know, long distance things. We listened to Frank talk about teleprocessing. And
right. Yep.
That had been a thing. But now we need all these little computers to talk to each other. And for that, we have to rewind a little bit to 1973. There's a guy named Bob Metcalf. He's working at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. And he invents this networking protocol and interface and everything called Ethernet. Details of which are not important. But there's, again, this is this period where a lot of people are trying different ways of getting computers to talk to each other.
So what was different about the Ethernet, or what was the killer app that caused the Ethernet to take off?
Ended up with PCs in the office and needing to connect them. You needed a LAN, and it ended up just being cheaper and easier.
What does LAN stand for?
Oh, thank you. Local Area Network. I don't know if we've said that yet.
No, we have not.
No. That's what you call that thing where you've got now these little computers on desktops in an office talking to each other.
It's called a LAN.
Yeah, you thought it was a way 20 years ago of having a party with your friends and playing video games together. Maybe you didn't do LAN parties. But
no, we didn't do LAN parties. We actually got together in a house and like hung out.
Yeah, well, no, you'd bring your computer to your friend's house. And I was raising children 20 years ago, but I did this a couple times. You'd bring your computer, you'd set up a LAN there, and you'd play a multiplayer game because you couldn't do it online back then. So LANs, yeah. There were other ways to do that. Like IBM had a thing called Token Ring. It was just a lot more expensive and kind of a pain.
I do remember actually Token Rings being a thing that we could support, but I never really understood what they were.
Yeah.
It was probably a little bit before my time.
Very much, yeah. People of our age, anytime we would have been working, Ethernet was the technology that had won, that had caused these LANs to work.
We could really rewrite this entire series as called The Piece of Technology That Ended Up Winning, because it seems like it's a theme over and over again.
Yeah, there's always lots of attempts at a way of doing things, and sometimes all of them are obviously bad until the killer emerges. Sometimes like, oh, they could all kind of do that, and then one just wins. Now, early 90s, you had your computer and you had your WordPerfect files, and maybe if you wanted to share files, you didn't have to put them on a floppy disk. Now you could share them with a computer on the LAN called a file server.
Right.
Or maybe your company would develop some kind of program that you ran on your PC, some custom tool for managing the sales process or customer support, or I don't know, whatever it is that you did in your function. And that talked to a database.
Ooh.
That was on another computer in the office that was just a bigger, beefier, more expensive PC. It was the same kind of thing, just with a chunkier case and a little more memory and a bigger hard disk.
So these earlier, what we would now call a server, what were just still microcomputers. We weren't harkening back to an earlier era. They were just larger microcomputers.
Exactly. There was nothing mainframe about them. Now, there are still, at this point, the early 90s, mainframes all over the place. There are still, as we record this in 2024, mainframes all over the place. These things don't go away. But this era is, now you've got these network-connected microcomputers, PCs. Some of them are servers. Some of them are clients. And so this client-server thing, and again, personal story. I'm this nerdy kid reading Byte magazine in the 80s, and they're talking about this new paradigm called client-server and the evil controlling priesthood of the mainframe is going to be done away with. And these guys wrote about this new paradigm where you had the computer on your desk, you had the server off in a closet somewhere else on the floor, maybe a different floor, and everything's connected by a LAN.
So stop for a second.
Yeah.
What was that LAN? Like, what was the physical manifestation of that LAN?
In the late 80s, early 90s, it would be probably a little round black cable that looked like a cable TV cable.
Okay, so a pretty chunky cable.
Or if you were cooler, it could be, what if you know what a network patch cable looks like these days, those started to emerge around then, the twisted pair Ethernet. So it was a cable that probably just went into the wall. And some IT person that did things you don't know about, they made the connection work. And this idea of the software runs on your computer and the data is on the server over there in the closet is so much more flexible and more democratic and more everything than the old mainframe paradigm. These guys wrote about it, Rachel, like it was ushering in the millennium. It was odd.
I have to say it from the distance of time, they seem pretty much the same.
I think it was a paradigm shift. I think that's okay to say, but the promises of the silver bullet were just a little overblown. Now, Rachel, I talked to Bill Inman.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. If you're a listener and you don't know why Rachel said wow, Rachel, why did you say wow?
I said wow because Bill Inman is one of the fathers of data warehousing, which is what I've spent my last 25 years of my life professionally doing.
Yes. Yes. He's a very big name in this space, in the professional circles that Rachel and I have, and really all of Rachel's career has been in analytics, and he's one of the founding fathers of the modern discipline. And we'll talk to him more in a future episode, but I asked him about this client-server era, since he was very much around then, and the silver bulletness of all the opinion writers. Here's what he said.
Let me give you a reaction that I know you're not prepared for, but client-server was one of the many silver bullets that vendors tried to sell. And our industry has a long history of falling for the silver bullet. Client server was just one more of those silver bullets. It had a few advantages to offer, but in terms of solving the basic problem, it didn't.
Now, that basic problem he's talking about, we'll dig into more in a future episode. But yeah, it was a little overblown and really interesting. I think it was an important paradigm shift in the way we, you know, the people who write software, the way we write it.
Yep.
But it didn't seem to really reduce crime or economic inequality. I'm not aware of.
It wasn't like the steam engine.
Well, right. I mean, honestly, that actually did have real effects.
No, I'm serious. The steam engine, as I've learned through the course of making these podcasts, changed everything all the time.
Yes. And client server changed the way programmers write programs, which, hey, to me, that's important, but it's not as much of a big deal.
After a short break, we'll look at the rise of the World Wide Web.
I'm Tim Bergman.
I'm Rachel Podreski.
This is Keyboard and Quill. We're going to keep going with the rise of the web.
So did the LANs develop into the internet? I mean, so we had the internet and we had LANs. How did we marry them and make the baby of the World Wide Web that we have today?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. LANs are computing technology that's a part of what you do at work. You know, your Wi-Fi connection at home, that's a modern extension.
Yeah.
That's a LAN. And so they're all around us, but the internet up till now, it has been a thing, but you kind of have to be pretty specialized to know. You're probably an academic computer scientist or
a government agency, as we've been learning about.
Yes, yes. But Rachel, tell us how the internet gets from that academic and government curiosity into something that we all know and live with.
It was actually this client-servery way that we were communicating, or that computers were communicating with each other, that introduced a need to have a common language or a common protocol that allowed these computers to talk to each other. So inside of a LAN, you would have the language or the protocols of your own organization. But once you went out into the internet, there had to be a shared and common way of everybody expressing the same thing. Actually, in 1989, Tim Berners-Lee at CERN demoed HTTP and HTML. So HTTP is Hypertext Transfer Protocol, and HTML is Hypertext Markup Language. And the combination of those two is really what ushered in the internet that we know today.
Yeah, he created the World Wide Web. As a computer scientist working at a particle accelerator wanting to come up with a way to share documents in this new client-server world.
Right. CERN needed to be able to talk to the Stanford Linear Accelerator, for example.
Yeah. I think initially he just wanted a way to publish documents and share them in this kind of internet-y way, but then it's on the internet. And so, yeah, Stanford and all these other nodes on the net can communicate.
And so all of these proto nerds were all there going, hey, cool, we want to go check stuff out. And how do we post new stuff? And about 1994, 1995, the World Wide Web, as we called it at the time, the internet really started taking off as something that everyday people could use.
Do you remember the first web browser you saw?
I used a text-based version.
Really?
At university.
Okay.
I had to take a class. It was required, was computer skills. In that computer skills class, we learned how to use Unix, which we spoke about, I think, earlier in this episode.
Yes, yes.
And learning to use Unix, we were introduced to a concept called markup language. So what I did is I built a little application that asked somebody a bunch of questions, and it would create a web page for them because we were taught about HTML, took an HTML template, create a little program that uses set and awk to replace parts of the HTML with people's names, their favorite color, and built them a very, very simple web page that got uploaded to the right place on the servers and allowed them to have their very own personalized web page.
So you put their answers to the question in a text file and you use those tools to mush that into this HTML thing.
Exactly.
Okay. Which, I mean, this is a thing I'm sure plenty of our listeners have seen HTML or vaguely at least know what it is, depending on where you are on the technicalness spectrum. That's amazing, doing that with set and awk.
Right. And I think the first browser we used was either Netscape or
Mosaic.
Yes, it was Mosaic. Yeah.
My first experience with the web was September of 1993. I saw a weather map that was an animated GIF. So this weather service was creating animated GIFs and showing a weather radar changing. And I think also that same day, the Klingon Language Institute, KLI.org, I think was already online.
Right.
Yeah. One of the early websites, early adopter. There you go. So that's the beginning, and the web had been a thing growing from CERN for a few years, but the wave really starts to break. And now Bryant Gumbel's talking about it on Good Morning America. It's a consumer phenomenon.
Right. And Rachel's making little programs for all of her friends to be able to create a web page. And I actually built a animated GIF that showed the phases of the Stonehenge and got a really good grade on that project because my professor was amazed.
Nice.
That I made a web page for this. I was using IRC at the time, which was called Internet Chat.
That was a text chat program.
Yep. Text chat program. And I remember getting a UI version of that not too long afterwards.
True story. I've never used IRC.
Really?
Isn't that strange?
So you don't know what slash me What happens when you do backslash me?
No.
Well, good to know.
Yeah.
I'll save that for a later time. But what also became very popular around that time?
What's that?
Email.
Yes, unfortunately, which hadn't just been created in the 90s, but initially it was a very novel, fun, quick, cheap way to send text messages.
And they made an entire movie out of it.
Yes, they did. Written and directed, I believe, by Nora Ephron, starring Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. You've got mail.
I actually got myself a Hotmail account in 1996, which is when Hotmail, I think, was being the first consumerly available.
Like email? Web-based email program. Yes, because back then email, and I'm sure plenty of people use an email client, but if you just use like Gmail now, everybody just gets it. It's a browser tab. You do it. But back then, if you used email, you had a program. That was your email program, and it connected to the internet and exchanged messages. Hotmail was like, oh, we're going to do it on the web.
Yeah. And honestly, the web interfaces were terrible.
So, and I think here's what's important. They were so bad, all right? And what you have to realize is if you're an office worker now, mid-90s, you've got a PC, it's running Windows now, 1995, you got Windows 95. It's like, okay, it's starting to be kind of a good graphical user interface. And your company might have some really cool, sophisticated graphical interface to your sales and customer service records, like we were talking about a minute ago. This client program running locally, talking to the database server somewhere else in the company. It was good. That program, that client server program, they were like, nice. And then we went to the web.
Right.
And it was like we're using a green screen terminal again, just a few more pretty colors.
And trying to do anything was difficult.
It really was.
I do want to point out something, though. In 1995, Netscape had their IPO, meaning that Netscape, the browser, had enough traction that it could go public. And we could say that that was really the start of the dot-com boom.
Yes.
Now, it was only 5 years later, on March 10th, 2000, that the first dot-com bubble peaked and started to bust. This was only 5 years.
Yeah.
So if we go back to the first episode of this series and we talk about the quickening pace of life, this only took 5 years.
Yeah.
For something to become something that nobody used, to going through the hype cycles of major Hollywood movies, people using browsers and getting internet connections through CDs in the mail, to pets.com.
Starting companies that are going to totally revolutionize the way you order kitchen cookware, because you get to do it on the web now.
And pet food.
Yes, dog food. That's going to work.
Right. Which, mind you, I still get my pet food from a company that sells it on the web now.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast it was when we look at how long it seems like things took in previous eras before our lifetime. It went from unknown to your nerdy friend, that's me, tells you about it, to it's all over the place, to poof, oh, that was stupid, we got a little crazy and maybe shouldn't have invested billions of dollars in ways to revolutionize the way we get kitchen cookware.
But it wasn't crazy. It was just the first step of a really good idea that people needed to figure out how to make better.
Right.
And I would say that by the late 1990s, as needs and requirements for these types of computers and these types of LANs and systems and very complicated equipment and very complicated architectures became more and more prevalent and more necessary, there was a rise of a different type of industry.
Right, because you got to think now, almost no matter what kind of business you are, you need a website.
Right.
And if it's just some static content or an order form or something, I mean, there were all kinds of places, you know, lots of ways to get that done now. It was harder back then, but you could still do it for $5-$10 a month, whatever. But what if you needed to now get your own servers and put them on the internet? Like, lots and lots of people suddenly had to do that, and most people don't know how to do those things.
Or even have the money to be able to do that, to hire people.
Yeah. And what if the power goes out? And how do you get a high-speed connection to the internet anyway? Because, you know, a lot of us were using dial-up at the time. And so how...
And what the hell is a DNS name?
what even is one? So yeah, as you were hinting at, you had the rise of this thing called, at the time, internet data centers.
Okay, can you give me an example of one of these internet data centers?
Yes.
We're not talking about Amazon at this point,
are we? We are not. No, Amazon exists at this point, but it's a way to buy books. I was a customer of one of these in the Denver area a few years later when we were calling them colos or co-location facilities. Think of it as a big, loud, cold, dry room with just a bunch of racks with computers in them and blinky lights all over the place. It's kind of awesome. Unpleasant to spend a lot of time in there because it really is cold and dry and like your hands will dry and crack. It's not a pleasant environment for a human being. But yeah, this is a place where you put a bunch of computers connected to the internet with reliable power and folks who maintain, kind of keep the lights on, as it were.
Now, but what happened if somebody like drove a truck into that internet data center?
Yeah, if you had all your servers only in that one data center, they drove a truck into it, well, you'd be offline now, wouldn't you?
Yeah, interesting.
And so now, oh no, I'd better get a second data center in a different city in case there's a tactical nuclear strike on my first one, or more likely a storm or a truck or something. You know, this idea of continuity of business operations across different data centers was this really hard problem people were solving back then.
So there's different types of companies that were trying to solve this problem. It wasn't AWS yet. One of the ones that I'm the most familiar with is called Rackspace, which started in October 1998. And they offered a way of getting a full server that you didn't have to buy or physically manage or even upgrade.
Yeah. It was like this rent-a-computer that you never saw. And when you know you use your computer and it says there's an operating system upgrade, you have to restart. Well, server computers do that same thing too. People did that for you.
Ooh.
You just paid a fee every month and there was like this magical computer in the sky. Was it even a real thing? You didn't know. You didn't care. It did its job.
But it does harken back to the idea of renting time. What were we calling that in the mainframe?
Time sharing.
Time sharing. Yeah. Back in the time sharing ways of the mainframes, except this is becoming more mainstream as it solved a problem that more and more people had.
Yeah. And now that you've got this big data center full of these machines that somebody's renting to you, people are optimizing, like, how's that computer made? Well, let's just make the cheapest server we can make, strip it down to the bare bones of what it needs to be to do that job. Does it need all that sheet metal? You know, people were trying to figure out the cheapest way to deliver that service they could.
So it didn't take very long for people to abstract that concept up a level. So not just talking about renting out the time or renting out the machines, but somebody, specifically Salesforce in 1999, had this idea of why don't we share software? So they're going to build a piece of software that lots and lots of different people could use.
And this is such a completely native, taken-for-granted idea for us now.
It really is.
It's worth going back to that time and saying, this was a little bit new and disruptive. At home, you had a subscription with a company called an internet service provider. And some of these companies, Salesforce is an example, are calling themselves application service providers.
Ah.
Where this isn't software you install. Because back then, you've had a CD, like you mentioned the AOL CDs. You
right.
stuck it in your CD drive and it...
Or even that DOS program that I used to have on my 5 1/4 floppy, right? I had to install these programs. And we started the top of this episode by asking, how often do we install software?
We don't do that very much anymore.
We really don't because of companies like Salesforce.
Like Salesforce.com. February 7th, 2000. This is right as the dot-com boom is kind of reaching its peak. They had this big event that heralded the end of software. And I remember their logo was a little like circle with a line through it that said software, no software. I remember thinking, of course there's software. It's just running on your servers. And, you know, I think they're basically saying, shut up, nerd. That's not what we mean. We mean you don't have to install software. You just use it through the web.
And for those who are unfamiliar with Salesforce.com, it is a Salesforce optimization software that allows you, or a CRM, customer relationship management application, that allows a company that sells stuff, which is probably not a company that wants to get into the tech business, but allows their Salesforce to manage their customer relationships.
Yeah. And it's completely central to, well, in tech, most companies' sales processes, your data is all there. It's been a dramatically successful business. And they were on the forefront of this idea of taking software and delivering it through the web browser.
But even some of the most innovative and forward-thinking CEOs of the time still were sort of skeptical of this idea.
Yeah, even as you move now through the 2000s, you get the dot-com bust and the recovery. And there is kind of an absurdity in that no software thing, like I was saying at the time. Of course there's software. What are you talking about? And this is the rise of the cloud. Nobody's saying cloud yet. That term is not in use. But a few years later, you were talking about some famous CEOs. This is Oracle's Larry Ellison commenting on this idea of the cloud. Now, Oracle, we should note, was kind of slow to move to the cloud. They were the database management software that was powering the web all through that first dot-com boom and powering business. And they were very much on a server somewhere, you know, this whole cloud thing.
And charging people a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Some quotes from Larry Ellison at the time.
The interesting thing about cloud computing is that we've redefined cloud computing to include everything that we already do. The computer industry is the only industry that's more fashion-driven than women's fashion.
Another one.
Maybe I'm an idiot, but I have no idea what anyone is talking about.
When they talk about cloud computing.
What is it? It's complete gibberish. It's insane. When is this idiocy going to stop?
I ask myself that every day.
He obviously had teenagers at
yes.
the time.
And I guess he had to play along. He said,
we'll make cloud computing announcements because, you know, if orange is the new pink, we'll make orange blouses. I mean, I'm not going to fight this thing. Well, maybe we'll do an ad. I don't understand what we would do differently in light of cloud computing other than market. you know, change the wording on some of our ads.
So as this idea of moving computing now off of your computer and into a server in a data center somewhere, a computer in a data center, this building
someplace
else.
Someplace else.
You don't know, you don't see, it's somewhere else. This is beginning to take hold. It's not without its critics.
After a short break, we'll see the cloud really take shape with Gmail. But first, let's pay for some extra storage.
At the tone, please record your message.
Hi, this is Channing from Santa Clara, California. Keyboard and Quill is made possible by StarTree, hosts of the Real-Time Analytics Summit, an annual conference that brings together professionals in the data space to discuss harnessing actionable insights from real-time data. Join us to learn, teach, connect, and have an amazing time with the best community in the user-facing real-time analytics world.
Register now at rtasummit.com.
I'm Rachel Podreski.
I'm Tim Berglund.
This is Keyboard and Quill. We're going to keep going with Gmail.
There are some people who are saying, wait a second, what's this cloud? The cloud is just somebody else's computer. Well, yes, precisely. But it seems like there are really big advantages to having it be somebody else's computer and putting them all in one place. For example, Google, who had lots of computers in one place, they ran giant data centers already by this point, on April 1st, 2004, announced Gmail. Now, Rachel, your Hotmail account that you said you got in the mid-90s.
Yep.
Okay. I also had one. I don't know if it's still active.
I know I did actually shut mine down, but I still have my Yahoo Mail account from 1998.
Good, good. Do you remember in Hotmail how much mail you could store?
No idea.
No idea. April 1st, 2004. Terrible day for a product announcement. People are going to think it's a joke.
You know, right. Oh, I actually remember this happening.
Yes. I feel like it's gotten better in recent years. But for a while, the internet was just completely insufferable on April Fool's Day. Google announces Gmail, which is just another web-based email client. Kind of a little slicker, right?
Yeah.
It was pretty cool because you'd click on things and the whole page didn't reload. It was just parts of the page would update. And you're like, ooh, how's that works? It was just easier and faster to use. And a gigabyte of storage for free.
Personally, I remember at this point, everybody knew that they had a race to get the username that they wanted.
Yep.
Because we learned from Hotmail and Yahoo Mail that if you were going to get an email address, you wanted to get the one that has the right...
That is the name that you want.
The name that you want, exactly.
And you had to wait for a friend to send you an invite because it's limited beta.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. So it takes us to today. Where are we today? We've gone from time sharing in mainframes and client-server architectures, internal company LANs, and then the internet, and then no software. Kind of feels that we've made this entire story to come to this one last place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is where computing is to a large extent. And there are still some things happening kind of around 20 years ago. Amazon started as Earth's biggest bookstore, became Earth's biggest store. You could buy everything from Amazon, you know, people doing their Christmas shopping on Cyber Monday. Kind of right. this sort of time.
This new thing, right?
Yeah, Cyber Monday. Which, I mean, it was glorious. But July 2002, Amazon launched this internal unit called Amazon Web Services.
What was Amazon Web Services? What was the big idea here that was more than just books and other people's stuff?
Kind of still pretty insider. It was that if you're a company that sells things on Amazon, but you need some sort of electronic integration, your computers need to talk to Amazon's computers. It was a way of Amazon exposing interfaces over the internet for your computers to talk to their computers for the purpose of selling things on Amazon.com.
Right. And they called them web services.
Yeah.
Which was actually a fairly common term at the time.
Yes. Yes. 2002. If you're a tech person, that's very much a term you're using a lot. Amazon starts that. Not really very revolutionary. But internally, wheels are turning. And they're having, I think, what some ideas that are transformational. On March 14th, 2006, I remember this.
Do you?
I do. They launched a service called Amazon S3, the simple storage service, SSS. And it was basically like a big hard disk in the cloud. You could just put data in S3. I mean, this is, again, a thing that a software developer does, but you write a program that uploads data into S3, and it's on a computer stored in a data center run by Amazon. It is, quote unquote, in the cloud.
And I think we can say that people were able to consume this concept at this point pretty easily, right? Because we have gone from people working at their desks and saving stuff to servers back in the 80s. And then after the internet, we were able to use our email. We didn't have to keep our email on local storage. We had no problems saving it on these kind of amorphous servers. Then software as a service, SaaS applications like Salesforce came out, and you are now storing your company's data on these servers somewhere.
And maybe your own personal data, personal finance stuff, whatever. I mean, more and more stuff is doing this. We started calling it software as a service, doing that sort of thing.
Right. So I think this makes complete sense that one of the most basic things that a computer does, which is a hard drive.
Remember stuff.
Right. I had to upgrade my PC as a child in order to have enough RAM to have a hard drive. We can now have a hard drive in the cloud.
Yeah. And again, this is only a thing that developers are using at this point. There is nothing really consumer about S3. But it was game-changing. You're like, wow, I'm never going to be able to exhaust the number of hard disks that Amazon is going to put into servers. I can just put stuff there and don't have to worry about it. Just pay per byte per month. And that was the genius. You're just paying a little bit for what you actually use.
And let's be clear, I don't think this is even today a consumer product.
It is not. No, none of this Amazon stuff. This is these things that Amazon is launching in 2006 are really the foundation of the cloud from a technical standpoint. And yeah, they're not consumer-facing things. You use Amazon as a consumer, you're buying stuff. If you use AWS, Amazon Web Services, you're probably a software developer writing code.
I don't think it's much of a leap now to say, all right, we've got storage.
In the cloud.
In the cloud. Why don't we actually have processing power in the cloud as well?
Right. Like Rackspace had been doing for a few years now. Amazon launched a service called EC2, the Elastic Compute Cloud, there's that word actually being used. And it was what Rackspace did. Now you can just say, hey, Amazon, I'm going to click a button and they'll spin up a computer. Now you have what appears to be a computer. Where is it? Have you ever seen it? Could you ever in principle see it? No, but there it is in the cloud.
So now we have what we like to refer to today as separation of compute and storage.
Yeah, these two different ways of doing those things.
And actually, the term cloud computing came from the competitors of Amazon today, Google. Google CEO Eric Schmidt coined the term in August of 2006 as well.
Yep. And of course, Google, who didn't have a competitive service to AWS at that point, had been doing all kinds of cloud computing.
Right.
Gmail is a cloud thing, and they're doing all these other things. But they launched their cloud platform in 2008, and Microsoft launched theirs about that same time. And really, the cloud was born.
And Larry Ellison actually announced one a few years later, too.
Yes, yes. Which, even in the experience of a technology person, I've heard Oracle Cloud mentioned the most in the dialogue of Iron Man 2. I think there's some good product placement money spent there, but not one of the major three cloud players. Those are Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. And a lot of the software you use over the web is probably running in a data center owned by one of those three companies. And now, Rachel, you pointed out we started this whole conversation by asking how long since you've installed software on your computer.
Right.
Let me put that differently. Imagine upgrading your computer.
Oh.
Which happens sometimes. You've got all your stuff and you want it on the new machine.
It always happens right before a really important meeting.
Exactly, exactly. But how much stuff do you really need to move over? It's gotten pretty automated. You know,
yeah.
The tools make it convenient, copy your files, but how many of your files are on your computer and how
very
much
few of,
it,
of them?
Yeah, it's not much.
Nope.
Yeah, unless you do some kind of specialized odd hobbies, like I do some video editing, that's all stuff kind of local, but most of what we do doesn't even live on our computers anymore. I mean, the program most of us are running during the day for documents, spreadsheets, email, messaging, whatever, is a web browser.
And all of my documents are stored in the cloud. I am fully bought into this technology.
I am too. Let's look back through this journey we've taken. We started in 150 BC with the Antikythera mechanism.
And not the one that was in,
not
Indiana the same
Jones.
One that was in
no,
the Indiana
the
Jones.
The historical artifact that was some kind of gear-based computer.
Which took us pretty rapidly to Pascal's Pascaline automatic calculator.
1819, you had Charles Babbage and his difference engine trying to automate procedural calculations.
And less than 100 years later, in 1890, the tabulating machine automates the census and allows them to get the job done on time.
Then in 1943, in World War II, the Allies create Colossus in the UK to break Enigma messages.
3 years later, in 1946, ENIAC was the first programmable computer.
1951, UNIVAC, built by the same people, was the first commercialized, productionalized mainframe computer.
And in 1959, IBM 1401 brings mainframes to the masses.
1960, the first video game, Space War.
And time sharing, where multiple people can use one computer.
Terminals, you can interact with your computer, not just run batch jobs on punch cards.
But in 1964, the IBM System 360 was a computer with a standard operating system.
In 1969, the very baby internet was born.
And in 1970, the PDP-11 becomes a mass market mini computer, and Unix has arrived.
1974, the internet is called the internet for the first time.
And in 75, microcomputers become a consumer product.
1982, the IBM PC is born, and microcomputers really start to enter the office in force.
And these PCs are widely cloned, and a giant business booms.
Office PCs are connected over local area networks.
And the first web browser and web server are demonstrated at CERN in 1989.
1995, Netscape IPOs.
Hotmail, hot on its heels in 1996, becomes the first cloud email service.
Internet data centers proliferate throughout the late 90s and early 2000s.
And in 1998, Rackspace launches, which offers a fully managed internet server you never have to see or touch or upgrade or anything.
1999, Salesforce launches, bringing sales management to the web browser and telling us we don't have to use software anymore.
Or maybe just not install it.
Right.
And in March of 2006, Amazon Web Services launches S3, the hard disk in the sky.
August of that same year, they launch EC2, servers in the sky.
And in October of 2006, the cloud gets called the cloud for the very first time.
And the era of cloud computing is off and running. Now, back in client-server days, if you wanted to install a server, that was a computer that you put in a closet somewhere, maybe a special room at the office, and you maintained at the office, and it had to handle a few dozen, maybe a few hundred people.
Right. But nowadays, that server is the cloud, and the computers or dumb terminals that you use to access those servers, those are iPads and smartphones and browsers.
Browser tabs, yeah. I think in a real sense, Rachel, we are in the era of the cloud now. And looking to the future, it's hard to see what comes after this because this is what we're swimming in. It's really hard to know what's next.
Yeah, but this is all pointing somewhere. And by the end of the season of this podcast, we'll see where that is.
The future of real-time data is just around the corner.
Our show is produced by Peter Furia, Noel Gallagher, and Tim Berglund. It was written by Tim Berglund
and Rachel Podreski. It was edited by Noel Gallagher, David Fine, and Peter Furia. And our amazing original music and sound design were created by Jeff Kite of The Voids.
Keyboard and Quill is made possible by StarTree, hosts of the Real-Time Analytics Summit. Register now at rtasummit.com.
You can subscribe to Keyboard and Quill for free wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. Please leave us a comment and a rating if you have a minute. And if you're a data professional, you should check out the Real-Time Analytics podcast, which we launched in early 2023. New episodes every Monday, link in the show notes. I'm Tim Berglund.
And I'm Rachel Podreski.
See you next time.